The Digital Poorhouse, using high-tech tools to profile, police, and punish the poor.
It felt like one of the riskiest lines I wrote in the book was, you know, the state doesn't need a cop to kill a person. That breaking up a family, that denying people access to housing or food or medical care kills people, and it kills people every day. We could decide tomorrow to say in the United States, no children is taken from their family because their parents can't afford medication. Like, no person like Gary Boatwright lives for 2 decades in a tent on the sidewalk, right? Like, no one like Omega Young dies because her medical coverage gets taken for missing an appointment. And that's a human rights approach. Public services, and we could decide to do that tomorrow. We have enough resources to do that tomorrow. And these systems, I'm afraid, act as a kind of empathy override that make us feel like, oh, well, at least the most deserving people are getting help. And everyone else, maybe there's something wrong with them.
That's Virginia Eubanks. We spend the hour with her talking about her award-winning book, Automating Inequality. It's about how the use of computerized algorithms are replacing human beings and deciding who is or is not worthy of getting help, and destroying lives in the process. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. The poor have been stigmatized throughout our history as a nation, from the poorhouses of earlier centuries to Ronald Reagan's trope of the welfare queen to Bill Clinton's draconian promise to end welfare as we know it. The poor have been blamed for their lot as an excuse to deny them resources. But the ushering in of the digital age has made this far, far worse. And it presages automated methods of digital control that are beginning to be used on all of us. In her book, Automating Inequality, Virginia Eubanks systematically investigates the impacts of data mining, policy algorithms, and predictive risk models on poor and working class people in America. The book is full of heart-wrenching and eye-opening stories from a woman in Indiana whose benefits are literally cut off as she lays dying, to a family in Pennsylvania in daily fear of losing their daughter because they fit a certain statistical profile. Automating Inequality first came out in 2018 and was reissued in a new paperback edition in August 2019. It won the 2019 Lillian Smith Book Award, the 2018 McGannon Center Book Prize, and was shortlisted for the Goddard Riverside Stephen Russo Book Prize for Social Justice. Virginia Eubanks teaches political science at the State University of New York, Albany. Well, Virginia Eubanks, welcome to Writer's Voice.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you so much for having me.
You start this book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. On a personal note, your partner Jason was mugged and seriously injured, and he had to go to the hospital. He thought he had health insurance, but it had been canceled. What happened?
Yeah, so this was one of the most challenging times in our life. Jason was injured really, really badly and required 7 hours of reconstructive surgery on his face and his head. And when he went to the emergency room, everything was fine. I had just moved to a new job and we're not married, but he's insured as my domestic partner. So I'd been in this new job for about a week when he was attacked. Everything was fine in the emergency room. Our health insurance worked just fine, paid off our emergency room costs. And then the day of his surgery, I went to the pharmacy to fill his prescription for pain medication and other things. And the pharmacist said, oh, no, we've canceled that prescription because you don't have health insurance. And I was like, yeah, we do. But in a panic, of course, ran home and called the insurer. And they said, oh, Yeah, no, you have insurance, but for some reason, we don't have a start date for your coverage. So everything's sort of on hold until your coverage starts. And I said, but, you know, you just paid a claim just a couple of weeks ago. And they said, oh, you know, it must just be a technical error. Somebody must have accidentally erased your start date in the database. And this is when the sort of alarm bells started going off in my head, where I was like, you know what? I study this for a living. I suspect I know what's happening here, which is we displayed a lot of the sort of red flag behaviors for insurance fraud. It was a brand new policy, and then we put tens of thousands of dollars of claims on it within a couple of weeks. Jason's medication include controlled substances like oxycodone. We weren't married. We were domestic partners. And so I asked at the time, I was like, wait, are you investigating us for insurance fraud? And they were like, oh, no. It's just a technical glitch. And so that's the story that I tell at the beginning of the book, because I think it's so important for people to understand that when these technical systems, when they target you for an investigation, even if you're in the right, it can be extraordinarily difficult and damaging to you, particularly when you're in one of the hardest moments of your life. So I really needed to be concentrating on my partner's healing and on his health and on my health at the time, which was also really strained by the stress of the attack. And we were worried about our safety and, you know, this very like baseline hardship that we were undergoing. And to feel like we were at that moment in our lives being targeted for a sort of digital investigation really felt like being kicked when we were down. I would have rather not had that experience and not been able to open the book with a personal sort of reaffirmation of the things I find in other people's lives in the book. But I also think it's really important for folks who are reading the book who haven't necessarily had firsthand experience with the public assistance system to understand that the tools that we innovate in places where there is not an expectation that people's rights will be respected, like public assistance, like prisons and jails, like refugee camps, like war zones, will eventually be used on everybody.
And was it a technical glitch?
Well, they told me that we didn't have coverage because my insurance hadn't started and that the bills for the surgery would not be covered. And then I sort of fought with them for several weeks, eventually realized that I should not be trying to fight this alone and asked my new employer to sort of go to bat for me. My new employer is much more powerful than I was. And as soon as my employer stepped in, they were like, oh, no, it was our mistake. You're fine. Mm-hmm. But after that point, we still had to deal with all of these bills that supposedly had not been covered by insurance, including, I think it was close to $70,000 for the surgery. And we did eventually settle all of that, but it was a huge hardship to go through having to deal with these like terrifying pink, you know, underpayment notices that came in the mail while we were also trying to protect Jason's health and make sure that we as a couple felt safe and healthy in our home. It was an incredibly difficult period for us.
Yeah, and Virginia Eubanks, this book is automating inequality. In this case, do you think if it was in fact what you suspected it was this some kind of computer algorithm that just flagged it, or was it a human being who said, this looks suspicious?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I'll never know for sure because they would not talk to me. They continued to just say, oh, it was just a slip of a finger, like somebody accidentally erased your start date. But from my reporting in all the other areas that I look at in the book, I suspect that it's a combination of those things, that these systems are these really complex combinations of explicit policy decisions that decide who is inherently suspicious and who will tolerate being investigated around sort of every aspect of their lives. Technical systems that are sometimes malintentioned and sometimes just not very well thought through about what the impacts on human beings are going to be when they're used. and sometimes the result of human decision making. Sometimes that decision making is biased. Sometimes that decision making is restricted in such a way that people's better human impulses can't be deployed in these systems. So it's a combination of sort of politics and people and technology, as it always is.
You looked at three different cases. You went to Indiana to look at a change in the welfare eligibility system. You went to LA to look at the unhoused and the homeless, and to Pennsylvania to look at the child protective system. But I was really struck how in Indiana, the whole system shifted away from this interpersonal kind of connection, and havoc ensued.
Yeah. So in Indiana, one of the things that's so, I think, important about that story is that there is a bigger sort of move afoot right now, particularly in public services, away from what's known as case management, which is the idea that a caseworker is responsible for a caseload of families to whom they are responsive and responsible. For better and worse, sometimes this like human bias really affects the kind of experience that people have with public assistance. And that's really important to acknowledge and be honest about. And that's particularly has damaging effects around race, but also around the way that people bring class-based assumptions into the work they do. So bias plays a role in human decision making, of course. But the move in Indiana is a move away from this case-based system and towards what's known as a task-based system. And what that means is basically the caseworkers are now seeing a list of tasks that drop into a sort of digital queue in their workflow management system. And rather than responding to a family with whom they've developed a relationship over time and whose context they might know, even if they don't know them personally, they might know the town where they live, they might live in the same sort of area. They're just responding to the next task on a list, and the next task goes to whoever the next open caseworker is. So what that means for caseworkers is that they can't use any of their sort of local knowledge. They can say, like, oh, it looks like you won't be eligible for food stamps, but they can't then say, oh, there's a food pantry near you. It's open on Tuesday nights. So that's the kind of thing that caseworkers really struggled with, was feeling like they were being de-skilled as workers. And on clients' side, the folks who were applying for or receiving public assistance in Indiana felt like they were, you know, talking to a robot. And in the same way that any of us will get frustrated talking to a robot when you're just like trying to get cable turned on at your house, it's the same kind of frustration, but layered with real fears about your survival or your children's survival, right? So on the other hand, side of this very sort of disconnected, inhumane conversation is your access to basic human needs, things like food and housing and medical care. And so to a person, the clients I spoke to in Indiana and Los Angeles and in Pittsburgh felt like, even though they had had very difficult relationships with caseworkers in the past, that they would still rather have a human being than a perfect computer, even if the computer made better decisions, because they felt like the computer couldn't understand their context. They couldn't argue with the computer. So even a flawed human being to them was better than a flawless but disconnected computer system.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with political scientist Virginia Eubanks about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Tell us one of the stories that you tell in the book from your study of the change in Indiana, and then I'll ask you a little bit more about the context within which that happened.
Sure. So I think probably the most heartbreaking story in Indiana is the story of Omega Young. So Omega was an African-American mother of two grown sons. She had the bad fortune to get really sick around the time that this, what they call the modernization of the eligibility system in Indiana, was happening. This move away from in-person contact to phone contact meant that when you were applying or recertifying for public assistance, what you would do is fill in an online form, and then they would automatically schedule sort of an interview with a call center worker for your benefits. If you missed that interview, it was known as a failure to cooperate in eligibility and establishing eligibility for the program. And that system saw any failure to cooperate in establishing eligibility in the program as intentional and used that as an excuse to basically block people from resources. So if you fail to show up for a meeting for whatever reason, that was seen as an affirmative refusal to cooperate. And that was then a reason they had for throwing you off your assistance.
And for example, the reason could be that they didn't mail out the notice until after the meeting.
Yeah, so that did happen. There's definitely stories about people receiving notices after the date of their meeting. In Omega's case, the reason that she had trouble making a recertification interview was she was in the hospital suffering from terminal ovarian cancer. So she reached out to her county workers, human workers, and said, hey, I can't make it. I'm in the hospital. But because she missed that telephone interview, they decided that she had refused to cooperate in establishing eligibility and kicked her off all of her benefits. So her Medicaid, her food stamps, she lost free transportation to medical appointments. And she did request what's known as a fair hearing, which is a process in public assistance where you can challenge the decision that the state makes in an administrative court. She requested a review. She died, I believe, on March 1st, 2009. 2 days later, they found that her denial of eligibility was incorrect and restored all of her benefits 2 days after her death.
Yeah, so this kind of goes to the point you make that the stakes are quite high, that people have died because of this. And I guess the question is this an accident of just technology, or is there a certain degree of design in this?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So one of the things I did in the book was the Indiana story to me is potentially what hackers would call a black hat story, right? Which is like bad intentions, malicious intentions. I don't know what was in the current, the governor at the time was Mitch Daniels, who is, by the way, a close colleague of our current vice president. I don't know what was in Mitch Daniels' heart. And so I can't speak to his personal intentions around supporting the really strong push towards privatization and automation of public services in Indiana. But one of my sources, one of the folks I interviewed for the book, was a Medicaid attorney in Bloomington, Indiana. And he said, at some point, it doesn't matter what their intention is, because if we were going to design a system that would deny people access to their basic human needs, it would not work any better than the system we got. And so I think to a certain degree, the intent matters less than the effect. And that's why I started all of the stories I tell in the book from the point of view of directly impacted people. So in Indiana, I started with the stories of folks who have been denied public services and denied public benefits. In Los Angeles, I started embedded in unhoused communities, both in Skid Row and in South Los Angeles. And in Pittsburgh, I started from the point of view of families who had been targeted for Child Protective Services investigations. Because I think often particularly when we talk about technology, we talk about the people who are designing the technology. We sometimes talk about the politicians who are regulating the technology. And we'll talk about users to the degree that users are consumers who bought it or downloaded the app. What I think is different about automating inequality than some of the other great writing about technology and social justice we've had in the last couple of years is it starts from the point of view of people who see themselves as targets of these systems. And I think that's a really different perspective than we normally hear. And I think we can't get to better systems or better politics or better understandings of the way technology and politics influence each other until we hear from the people who are most impacted by these changes.
Yeah, I totally get your point that intent, if the outcome is the same, then that's what counts. Yet you also, Virginia Eubanks, in Automating Inequality, you do provide a historical context for this that is rooted in a certain view of the poor, the undeserving poor versus the deserving poor. I wonder if you could maybe briefly give us an overview of that history, and this is pre-technology, but and then how that informs the current situation.
Yeah, so I use this metaphor in the book of the digital poorhouse. I really like the metaphor because it grounds us in a really long history of the way that we view poverty and economic inequality in the United States, and specifically how we view people who reach out for help to their communities or to their government when they're suffering from economic deprivation. So this is always where I thank my editor, Elizabeth Discard at St. Martin's, who saw this manuscript and realized that I had written a 93-page history chapter that went back to 1607 and was like, oh, God, Virginia, please don't do this to them. And worked with me closely to get it down to a nice, svelte little 26-page history of the last 400 years of poverty policy in the United States. It centers around a couple of really important moments, but the most important to know is the moment that we invented a very different manifestation of the same kind of ideas we're seeing today, which is the moment that we decided that the best response to poverty was to build actual brick and mortar county poorhouses. This is something that most people kind of know existed, right? We have it in our language. We say like, oh, kids, you're going to send me the poorhouse. So we know that this exists. In many communities, there's still a street or a road called Poorhouse Road or Poor Farm Road. That's where the poorhouse was. But somehow we don't learn that history. And basically what happened in the United States is that around 1819, when there was a huge economic crisis in the U.S., economic elites got really worried, not about the effects of poverty on their neighbors, but about the effect of their neighbors asking for help on their taxes. And they did what economic elites generally do when they get panicked, and they commissioned a whole lot of studies. And the studies basically asked, what's the real problem here in this panic, in this crisis, this economic crisis of 1819? Is the problem poverty, lack of access to resources, or is it what they called at the time pauperism? And pauperism just means asking for help because you're suffering economically. Not surprisingly, considering where these, you know, surveys had been designed, they all came back saying, oh, the problem's not poverty. The problem's pauperism. The problem is that there is this burden being put on the state and on the community, on communities by poor people asking for help. So what we need to do is build a new technology to separate out the truly worthy from the sort of shirkers and the lazy and the dishonest. And the technology that they developed at the time was the brick and mortar county poorhouse. And basically what it did was incarcerate people who asked for help and raise the sort of barriers to receiving benefits so high that no one but the absolutely most desperate people would ask for help. So these were institutions where, in order to enter the poorhouse, if you had these rights at the time, the early 1800s, so of course not everyone had these rights, but you had to give up your right to vote or hold office. You weren't allowed to marry when you were in the poorhouse. You were separated from your children, who were then sort of farmed out as free labor to middle-class families as domestic or agricultural labor. And the death rates at some of these institutions were as high as 30% annually. So that's like a third of people who entered poorhouses every year died. And so these are really horrifying institutions. And I believe that that's sort of the deep social programming that we see in these new tools, in these tools of what I talk about as the digital poorhouse. That deep programming is about this idea that what our sort of poverty institutions and policies should do is a kind of moral diagnosis. They should serve as a moral thermometer around deciding who deserves help, rather than developing a universal floor that is under everyone. And that's the sort of philosophy that is sort of invisibly, deeply built in to these technologies and keeps arising as diversion or as digital surveillance or as other ways to do kind of moral diagnosis on people who are asking for help.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with political scientist Virginia Eubanks about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. There have been waves, up and down waves of this, you know, times when there was more access and more rights and less access and less rights. I think we're in the latter now. For example, you talk about the New Deal. And in the New Deal, there was a very stark contrast between those who were seen as deserving, that is, widows and orphans, and those who were seen as not, which was, you know, largely people of color.
Yeah. And so I think this is one of the great tensions in the work that folks are trying to do by bringing these sort of evidence-based, supposedly more objective technologies into public assistance. Part of the good work that they're trying to do is ferret out patterns of discriminatory decision making. And that has been extraordinarily impactful on people of color, but also single women and lesbians and people who are seen as deviant in any way were largely blocked from access from the public assistance system well into the 1960s, when the National Welfare Rights Movement had a number of really important legal successes. So they challenged basically this whole suite of discriminatory eligibility laws. Things like, they're known as things like man in house, which meant if there was a man sort of that you were in any kind of relationship with, he just immediately became financially responsible for your children so you could be denied. Or suitable home, if a caseworker came into your home, and often they came in the middle of the night with police, but if they came into your home and found that it was too dirty or there was something about your parenting that was unacceptable to them, they could block you from benefits. It's not surprising in the United States that these rules were most used against women of color, particularly single women of color. So for decades, people of color, single women, sexual minorities were effectively blocked from receiving the public assistance they were entitled to by discriminatory eligibility rules until the National Welfare Rights Movement in the 60s and 70s explicitly had a legal strategy of knocking those rules down. Now, one of the things that's really important about the history that I tell in the book is you hear today from a lot of people who build these tools that the point of those tools is to ferret out the remaining discrimination that exists in the system. And that's a good objective. But if you look at the history, actually, the moment you see what I talk about as the digital poorhouse, the new poorhouse, the electronic poorhouse arise, is actually that moment when those laws are struck down. And public assistance, for really the first time in U.S. history, right around 1970, is open to everyone equally. That's the moment we see these digital tools enter into the story. And I really suspect that these tools are as much about diverting people from accessing their newly gained entitlements and creating sort of an objective appearing shield that says, like, we're not just discriminating against people. Now the computer says that that person isn't eligible. That's a really different political strategy than just allowing discriminatory eligibility rules. That won't stand under the new way we think about equity and equal access to the law. But if the computer says you're just not eligible, then that gives you kind of a front to continue the discriminatory diversion of people from public benefits that they need and deserve to keep their families safe and healthy.
So you mentioned the National Welfare Rights Organization, you know, that really was an organization of women on welfare, largely women of color, who were able to get legal rights establishing, you know, as long as you fit the income guidelines, you had access to these resources. And maybe that lasted for not even 20 years, 15 or so years. Then you get President Bill Clinton comes in. And he ends welfare as we know it, for the first time putting on pretty strict, you know, lifetime limits and other requirements, at the same time that he's also bringing in policies of mass incarceration. And I didn't see it in your book, but I wanted to ask you, do you see a connection between these two programs that so vastly changed the face of America?
Yeah. So I think one of the conversations that I was really hoping to engage in is a conversation about the sort of carceral state, this idea of how much of our culture relies on mass incarceration as a solution to really deeply social, political, and structural problems. And there's been some really extraordinary work around thinking about kind of the digital carceral state. So like what it means to move from incarcerating people in physical institutions like jails and prisons to electronic incarceration. So what it means to live with an ankle shackle, for example. And so I think there's been some really extraordinary work around incarceration, and it's understood as social control. But we're not doing the same work necessarily in public assistance. Many people still see public assistance as primarily, charitable and don't think of it as a mechanism of social control. It felt like one of the riskiest lines I wrote in the book was, the state doesn't need a cop to kill a person. That breaking up a family, that denying people access to housing or food or medical care kills people, and it kills people every day. And if we really want to be serious about thinking about the relationship between racial and economic justice, for example, or thinking about decarcerating an abolition perspective to social justice, we need to also think about these programs that act to limit people's futures and squander human potential in ways that I think many people experience as carceral, as punishment.
Virginia Eubanks. Stay tuned for more of our conversation with her about her book, Automating Inequality, after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Now, let's continue with my conversation with Virginia Eubanks about her book, Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. You mentioned before that there can be ways in which using technology, using big data, can help. And you go to LA, where you go, as you said before, to Skid Row and other communities where there are a lot of people who are unhoused. And there's a program there that I'd like you to describe that did benefit some people, but also had real problematic issues. So I just wonder if you could, give us that pro and con there.
Yeah. So and this is one of the things that I did really intentionally in the book is I started with these sort of black hat this story that is more on the black hat side of the spectrum, but I didn't want to leave readers there. I wanted to sort of step them into more and more complicated stories, both complicated in terms of the technology, but also in terms of the sort of morals of the sort of ethical complexity of the issues. So I think across the book, the cases get more and more, they get harder and harder to say what the right thing to do is. And so the middle case is this case of a technology that's called by proponents the Match.com of homeless services. It's a system that's called the Coordinated Entry System. It's not just in Los Angeles. In fact, it's really become sort of standard practice in pretty much every community in the United States and increasingly abroad as well. And basically what Coordinated Entry is supposed to do is collect a lot of information about unhoused people, rank them on a scale of most to least vulnerable to some of the worst effects of being unhoused. And those are pretty serious effects, right? Like, so death or mental health crisis or illness or violence, and then match them with the most appropriate available housing resource through a set of algorithms that do this matching. And there is incredible reason to try to be making the most objective choice possible when dealing with the housing crisis in a place like Los Angeles. So as of the last point in time count, when I was writing the book, there are 54,000 unhoused people in Los Angeles County. So that's my whole town. I live in upstate New York. I live in a small city called Troy, New York. It's my entire city, plus about 5,000 people are unhoused in Los Angeles County. There's an encampment in just about every neighborhood in Los Angeles County. It's really an extraordinary humanitarian crisis. So I absolutely understand being the frontline worker in that situation and seeing, 100 people a week and only having enough resources to help one or two of them. I don't want to make that decision. But when you look at the coordinated entry system a little more closely, there are some real concerning sort of details to the way the system works. One of them is that it requires unhoused people to release some incredibly intensely personal information about themselves, including things like whether or not they're currently trading sex for drugs or money, whether they've thought about hurting themselves or someone else, their mental health history, their physical health history. And it asks them to share that information, though they sign an informed consent form, in a situation that can't really be seen as voluntary, right? Because being in the system and being ranked highly in the system makes it much more likely that you're going to get access to housing in Los Angeles County.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask about this because I used to be a social worker, a clinical social worker. And I looked at those questions and I thought, well, these are the kinds of questions I always ask people. I actually was an emergency clinician that would evaluate people who were in crisis. And so we had to ask extremely, you know, intense personal questions, and it would go into our notes, and I'm sure those notes stayed around for a long time. So, you know, for me, I thought, well, doesn't this make sense if you want to provide supportive services to people? My real question comes with who gets to share, who gets to see this data?
Yeah, and that's where it becomes, I think, a real issue with coordinated entry as well. So, actually, I think these are not bad questions for establishing your vulnerability, right? If you're currently trading sex for drugs or money, if you're thinking about hurting yourself, like, you are in crisis. And if we have to make really difficult triage decisions, then you should be scored more highly. The problem with coordinated entry is that in Los Angeles, it's currently held in their Homeless Management Information System, HMIS. And under current federal data regulations, law enforcement can request information out of HMIS and can be given it based just on an oral request. So no oversight, no written request required, no warrant required, and they can't get anything they want. So they can't just say, like, we're going to write an algorithm that, like, looks for everybody who says they're currently trading sex for drugs or money and then, like, creates an arrest list. They can't do that, but they can walk in to a social services agency and say, I need information about John Brown. And though the caseworkers are not required to give it to them, they are allowed to give it to them under the current federal data regulations. So I had unhoused folks, people like Gary Boatwright, who I grew quite close to over the course of doing the reporting for the book, who said it felt like they were being asked to incriminate themselves in exchange for a slightly higher lottery number for housing. And that just felt profoundly unjust, unfair, and it felt like it made them more vulnerable, not less vulnerable. So that was one of the major concerns about coordinated entry.
Has it been challenged on any legal basis? I mean, people give consent, so it doesn't come under the Fourth Amendment, but, you know, it's a little bit like coerced confession.
Yeah, so as far as I know, no, there has been no challenge to coordinated entry, except for there has been some really, one of the organizations I worked with in Los Angeles has just been doing extraordinary work for many decades there, Los Angeles Community Action Network, or LACAN. They've continued to sort of keep an eye on the system. But I think overall, because we're so open to arguments about triage approaches to services, that this is seen as like maybe a regrettable but necessary response to the incredible intensity of the housing crisis in the United States. There, in no county in the United States is there enough low income or affordable housing. In no county in the United States. But this is one of the other problems, I think, with coordinated entry and tools like it, is they're built on this assumption that there are not enough resources for everyone. And all of the designers I spoke to of these systems were very different people, were working in very different situations, came from very different political orientations. But to a person, they all used the language of triage when they talked about their systems. They said, look, there just is not enough for everyone. We have to make incredibly difficult choices. We need to make those choices more objectively. And that's what data and technology does for us. And what I try to have conversations with them about is that this language of triage is not actually appropriate for the situation that we find ourselves in. Triage is really only appropriate if there is an emergency that is time limited, and if there are more resources coming, then it's appropriate to use triage. if this is not a one-time crisis, and if there are not more resources coming, then it's not triage. What it is rationing. So they're building systems that rationalize rationing. And that, I think, deeply philosophically is a problem with these systems. They assume there's not enough for everyone. We could decide tomorrow to say in the United States, no children is taken from their family because their parents can't afford medication. Like, no person like Gary Boatwright lives for 2 decades in a tent on the sidewalk, right? Like, no one like Omega Young dies because her medical coverage gets taken for missing an appointment. And that's a human rights approach, public services. And we could decide to do that tomorrow. We have enough resources to do that tomorrow. And these systems, I'm afraid, act as a kind of empathy override that make us feel like, oh, well, at least the most deserving people are getting help. And everyone else, maybe there's something wrong with them. Maybe they belong in jail. Maybe they should just, you know, they should just not take care of their kids and get a job. Or maybe you should split up that family and put those kids in an orphanage. And that's when we get back to this deep, deep social programming of the poor house, this idea that our system is supposed to do a moral diagnosis, supposed to decide who deserves help, when in reality, every human being deserves access to their basic human needs. There's an activist who I really admire named Sherry Honkala, and she has this great line where she says, yeah, there's an algorithm for housing. She does a lot of housing where she was unhoused herself. She said, we call it the belly button algorithm. Like, if you have a belly button, you deserve housing. And that's as complicated as the math needs to be.
In other words, housing is a human right. Medical care is a human right. Education is a human right. But you mentioned families, and that's your third example in the book, Virginia Eubanks, in Automating Inequality. And that is, you go to Pennsylvania in a system that has developed an algorithm. It seems Big Brother, and yet there is something that makes some sense about it. Well, why don't you explain the algorithm? What is it trying to suss out?
So the tool is called the Allegheny Family Screening Tool, the AFST. It's actually been written about and quite positively by a number of people, including in the New York Times. So it is a tool that is supposed to be able to help Child Protective Services there, which is called CYF, Children, Youth, and Family Services in Allegheny County. It's supposed to help them sift through reports of abuse or neglect that they get both from their hotline, their county hotline, and from folks who are mandated reporters. So people like priests and teachers and nurses who are required to report any suspicion they have of abuse or neglect, to sift through those calls or reports to identify which children are most likely to be abused or neglected in the future. So this is a predictive tool, and that's what makes it different from the other tools in the book, is that what it does is it goes through 20 years of data that are collected in a data warehouse that the county built back in the late 90s. It sifts through that data to look for what they believe are indicators of abuse or neglect in the future. And it creates a screening tool that gives every family who is reported on a risk score from 0 to 20. And if the score is high enough, it automatically opens an investigation of that family by Children, Youth, and Family Services, unless it's overridden by a supervisor. So you can override the automatic opening of an investigation. And when I was there, at least, which was 2 years ago now, they were actually overriding quite a few cases because they did not think the tool was many people in the office did not feel the tool was very reliable.
So, that's scary.
Yeah, it's scary to parents. Certainly scary to parents and also scary to some frontline workers. And so I'll tell you why. So in Allegheny County, like in the other places I worked, I started by talking to folks who feel like targets of the system, to families. And parents who had been targeted by Children, Youth, and Family Services in the past told me that they were really, really concerned about what are known as false positive problems. This is the tool identifying them as potential risks to their children in the future when they felt there was no risk of them harming their children. And largely, they believed that they were at increased risk because they were asking for support from the county in a lot of different areas of their lives. So one of the real issues with this tool is that the only data that the tool really has access to is data that is collected through the county's programs. And the only folks who really access the county programs are poor and working class families. So if you are a professional middle class family and you say one of the parents has an issue with an addiction, they're going to go to their employer-provided, insurance, private-covered doctor. They're going to ask for support, or they're going to go to rehab. But that's going to be covered by private insurance, not by the county. And so their information is not going to go into the system. If you ask for support, though, with an addiction through the county office of drug and alcohol, then your information goes in the system. If you get help with caretaking from a nanny or from an au pair, your information doesn't go into the system. If you get county subsidized childcare funds, your information does go into the system. So parents saw that because they were more surveilled than other families, they were being seen as riskier to their children. And they were really concerned that that would become sort of a feedback loop where because they were more surveilled, they were seen as riskier. Because they were seen as riskier, they were more surveilled. And then their whole communities become sort of trapped in this feedback loop of injustice.
So a parent who is trying to do the right thing by getting addiction services asks for addiction services, and then this puts them on a list of parents who may be engaged in potential child abuse, which seems to be rather self-defeating on the face of it. Is there anything in these algorithms that judges the impact to a child welfare of taking a child away from a parent?
No, that's not in the algorithm. And one of the things that's really interesting about this case is that this is one of the best of these tools, not one of the worst in the country, because they've done a lot of the things, the people building the tool have done a lot of the things that sort of progressive critics of algorithmic decision making ask them to do. They've been remarkably transparent about what's in the tool, though not 100% transparent. It's lodged in a public agency, so there's some kind of built-in accountability to the democratic process. And they even did some kind of participatory design where they sort of worked with caseworkers and parent advocates as they were sort of building the tool. So this is really one of the best examples. There are much scarier examples of this, but that's actually why I wanted to write about it, is because it still raises some really profound issues about whether or not these tools are appropriate to use in making decisions about whether or not we're going to split up families. So they have released a list of all of the variables that go into the algorithm. One of the things that's really challenging, though, is they haven't released the weights of those variables, and they haven't released whether they're positive or negative. So in arguing with me after the book came out, one of the things that the county said is like, look, accessing some of those services is actually positive in the algorithm. Like, it actually lowers your risk score if you're on some of these programs. But they won't tell us, they won't show us which ones and by what percent. So it's very hard to know which programs actually raise your risk score and which ones lower it. So that sort of lack of clarity on the system itself is I think part of what's driving these real sincere and legitimate fears of families, that they're going to have to pick and choose which programs they use in order not to raise their risk score and lose their children.
And just like we talked about when it comes to housing, let's think about what might have been a different approach. Because when I was a social worker back in the 1980s, the push in Massachusetts, where I then lived, was on family reunification. The idea was that it was not good to split up families except in the most extreme of cases, and that you would bring to bear on the family a holistic range of services, including having social workers going to the home for hours per week to see what the family needed, to give the parents a break, to teach them, you know, better parenting. I mean, there may have been some problematic issues with it, but it was, of course, expensive because it was a lot of services. And I do believe that that has, by and large, fallen away.
Yeah. So people will talk about, particularly scholars of child Protective Services will talk about this sort of push and pull between family reunification and child safety. One of the things that I think is really important to know about this tool is it was built by a very energetic new leader who was brought in after a really horrific case where a child died in Allegheny County. And often we see these new tools sort of unfurled after a real tragedy has taken place. So we come back to this language of triage, right? So the county would say, we do not have enough resources to provide everybody with the kind of services we'd like to. So we have to identify the people who are most at risk. And there's, again, there's really good reason to feel that way when you're embedded in the system and when you think there are not going to be any more resources. But I believe a human rights approach that says, no family gets broken up because of poverty, right? 75% of investigations of child protective services across the country are because of neglect, not abuse, not physical abuse, not sexual abuse, not emotional abuse even, just neglect. And neglect basically is the same thing as poverty. It is not having enough food in the house. It's not having safe housing. It's having to leave a kid alone because you can't afford childcare when you go to work or because you don't have control over your work schedule. All of that is textbook neglect. And the great majority of child separation from families is because of a neglect, not abuse. It's because of poverty. And I think the concerns that families have that they are being targeted for using services, whether or not it's factually accurate in every single case, is a very reasonable and very correct analysis of their situation, right? That there is this effect of these systems where if you feel targeted by a digital system that's red flagging your parenting, you're going to avoid services. You are not going to go to the ER when you feel like you need to go to the ER, or you're not going to reach out for mental health counseling if you think that that's going to put you into, I mean, literally this thing is a thermometer and it has red at the top and yellow in the middle and green at the bottom. So if you think it's going to drive you into the red, like you're not going to reach out for those resources. And we're really punishing the people who are doing exactly what we want them to do, which is saying, they're saying like, I need support with my parenting. And that's, I think, exactly the opposite of what we want to be doing.
Well, and talking about punishment, let's talk a little bit about immigration, because as I'm speaking with you now, there have been a number of reports in the press about the use of big data basically to surveil and punish those who are undocumented. For example, they're going to be taking DNA of undocumented immigrants who are detained in public housing. If there is one undocumented person in public housing and they're using big data, I believe, in order to identify that, then the entire family is going to lose their housing. I guess that's the proposal by the Trump administration. There's also the use of facial recognition. So I wonder if you could talk about how this use of automation, of digital surveillance, is being used to punish people who try to come to this country.
Yeah, so I think one of the real weak points of automating inequality is that I did not spend as much time as I should connecting the history of the poorhouse to the history of migration to the United States. So 1819 is both this economic crisis, but it's also this peak in migration, particularly migration from Eastern and Southern Europe. So a new kind of migration in the United States. And I think that the histories of attempting to restrict migration and the use of these new tools for punishing people who ask for help, and sort of the way those threads are twined together, like the way that the treatment of native poor folks, and by here I mean folks who are naturalized citizens or who live here, not Native Americans, though there's an interesting story in that as well, but how the treatment of poor citizens is really connected to the treatment of people seeking to migrate to the United States. So though poorhouses were actually quite mixed in terms of race. They were majority migrants for long periods of their history. So I haven't specifically done work on migration. I know some people are doing work on that now, but I think just like the other sort of cases I talk about where there is sort of an authorization to experiment on very vulnerable people, that of course we're going to see this, particularly in cases where people do not have legal status in the country. They literally have no rights and they can be treated however horribly or well we choose to treat them. And so, yeah, you see facial recognition at the border, and then you see it in public housing, and then you see it in your workplace. Or you see diversion from programs first being legislated against folks who don't have legal standing in the country, and then you see it against poor people who are residents of the country, and then you see it on to everyone. So I think it really makes sense to pay attention to these places where people don't enjoy basic rights, because that's where this stuff gets tested. That's where the sort of innovative disruption happens, is where people don't always have the resources and they need to fight back effectively. So where people are really vulnerable.
And your book is a cautionary tale. Before we go even further down this road, I think we all need to take the lesson that, just like when they come for the most vulnerable, the less vulnerable are not far behind. Virginia Eubanks, it's a terrific book, and it's a terrific read also. Automating Inequality, How High-Tech Tools Profile, Police, and Punish the Poor. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I want to say one more thing, because this is something that comes up a lot, which is I also think the book is really hopeful. That one of the things I witnessed while I was doing the reporting for the book was sort of the incredible resilience and generosity and humor that people manage to have even when they're targeted by the state in these really intrusive, invasive, and frightening ways. And so I have this conversation with my mother all the time. She's always like, I don't know how you can do the work that you do. It's so hard. It must be so depressing. And I'm always surprised by that. I always say, actually, no. Like this, it's not depressing at all. It gives me so much hope. And so I want to sort of end by saying, right, like in the case in Indiana is the case in point. In Indiana, the people of Indiana saw what was happening from the system and they refused to be part of it. And they pushed back against the state and they won. And they forced the governor to end this contract they had with IBM 3 years into a 10-year contract. And they just refused to be part of this really damaging work. And I just think that it's really important to end on a note that there's nothing inevitable about the effect these tools are having on poor and working class communities, and that we can absolutely challenge these things and win.
Well, thank you so much for that.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Virginia Eubanks. On October 14th, The Guardian published a series of articles based in part on Eubanks' work. Find the links at writersvoice.net. You'll also find a link to some extended quotes from her book, Automating Inequality. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.